Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Over the last decade, more than 49,000 total cases of human trafficking have been reported to the Polaris Project and National Human Trafficking Hotline. But those seeking to end the exploitation of men, women, and children say the number of victims is vastly underreported. This week, a regional task force that aims to end sex trafficking said they're turning their attention from raising awareness to training community members to spot victims. The task force is made up of community leaders, law enforcement, tribes, and victims' advocates. Kathy Herms is with Lutheran Social Services in Duluth, and she's a member of the Twin Ports Trafficking Task Force.
I think a lot of people just still do not accept that trafficking is a daily activity in our area, that the hunting phenomenon adds to the trafficking occurrences, that big events like Grandma's Marathon or the tall ships or professional baseball games down in the Twin Cities adds to the amount of people being trafficked. I think that the fact that school-age children are drawn into trafficking is something that many of us just struggle to accept as taking place in our community.
Because you gave a statistic, right? Was it 1 in 4 Native girls or boys? Or
yeah, for the rates of being drawn into exploitive situations for Native children and Native women are astronomical. I mean, in some instances, I've seen studies where it's 10 times more likely that a Native person will be drawn into exploitation situations than a person who's white.
So why are Native communities more disproportionately affected by human trafficking or sex trafficking?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Racism is certainly a reason. Vulnerabilities associated with colonization resulting in people living on reservations lends to this. Misogyny, disregard for women, so our high rates of murdered and missing Indigenous women. I mean, I could go on a long time here, but binary supremacy in general, those systems where we've got one category of person privileged and powerful over another category of person. And for our Native women, the issue of their status as a woman, the issue of their status as being not white, the issue of their status as often being living in poverty conditions, all amplify the possibilities that they could be a vulnerable person and taken advantage of.
And children are already vulnerable.
Right, yeah. Yes, children by virtue of their age, that binary supremacy, being a kid as opposed to being an adult with the inherent powers you have it as an adult.
Well, what's the motivation there? I mean, why be grooming children? You know, I mean, none of it makes sense, frankly. But, I mean, just what are some of the practices that they're using to prey upon children?
Well, children are at risk in shopping malls. Children are at risk, I'll say teenage children are at risk in situations where a company comes through town and they're doing auditions for modeling or dancing. Oftentimes those are fronts for identifying young people for trafficking purposes. Kids just make poor decisions in general. And oftentimes our young people are looking for someone to pay attention to them. If they're lacking that at home, they're lacking that in school. If there's someone who comes along and says, hey, you look great, you could be a model, that young person is very likely to follow that adult and pretty much accept what they're going to say. And before you know it, they are no longer being groomed. They're actually in the pipeline of being trafficked.
And they don't realize that that's the way things are going?
They really think that they are trying out for a modeling position. And there is no modeling position oftentimes behind those endeavors.
And by the time they realize, it's often too late, or they're fearful of what might happen to them?
Right. Could be dangerous for them to break away by the time they realize that they are not going to a modeling gig out in Los Angeles.
So people like you have been working on this issue for a long time to draw awareness to it. Do you feel like things are any better than they were, say, 10 years ago?
Yes, things are better than 10 years ago in a number of regards, because we're getting legislative attention here in Minnesota, because we have that safe harbor law. Not all states have that. And as a result of that, a significant amount of money, millions of dollars, have been legislatively granted for housing services. We have safe harbor housing programming here in Duluth, and also to support regional navigators. Mel Alvar's name was mentioned a number of times here. She's our regional navigator. It's her sole job to be out there educating people how to identify young people who are trafficked, but also to herself to offer the supports that she can. So, you know, it's great to kind of step back and take that longer view, because the issue still looms large. It's hard to see your progress in light of the large number of people still being trafficked. But yeah, we've come quite a ways. I think we have to broaden our circles to rural areas, to get the people in rural areas to see that it is a problem there. And that stat I gave about 64% of the services provided through Safe Harbor are services provided in Greater Minnesota, not the metro area. So I think a big reckoning needs to take place in rural areas.
And is this more difficult to be doing this kind of work in this area too, given that there are so many different jurisdictions, you know, tribal communities, various state and local governments with Minnesota and Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's one thing for an individual agency to take on as its mission to do work to try to minimize or prevent trafficking. But yeah, what you just mentioned, to cooperate across agency lines, across county lines, across state lines, across tribal lines, complicates the issue significantly.
So what are some of the things that you would like to see to move the needle forward? You know, we've accomplished some things. What yet is left to be done?
Good movement of the needle would involve more, I'm going to say, male-identified people engaging and understanding the unearned power that they have, their privilege, due to their gender or their sex. If we can take a look at hyper-masculinity, or some people call it toxic masculinity, and the flip side of that, hyper-femininity, and let go of the codes that define those two phenomena, I think that could bring us a long way. If you break that, you break all kinds of binaries of imbalanced power. That's that's kind of dreamy and theoretical, but I really think the made-up codes of hyper-femininity and hyper-masculinity just feed this particular phenomenon, this trafficking exploitation phenomenon.
Well, and this hypermasculinity or the toxic masculinity, why do you think that exists?
Because it advantages a certain category of people to keep it in existence, the people in privilege. And if you see that the conditions that give you that power are being threatened, you fight back. Sociopolitically, I'd suggest we're in a time of great hyper-masculine flare-up, because there's fear, rightfully fear, that a category of people who have had a lot of power and privilege are losing it, necessarily so, because there's a lot of others out there who deserve to have that power and privilege shared.
So what do you want people in this area to know as you're going through these month-long of events to draw awareness to the issue of human trafficking or sex trafficking?
I'd want people to know that even though the legislature did offer up millions of dollars over the course of the last couple of years, that there's so much more that can be done and needs to be done beyond what that funding allowed for. I'd want people to know that this community is missing people, mostly indigenous women. I would want people to know that our young people are at risk just by virtue of their youthfulness, but they're also at risk because of their, devotion to social media, because a lot of trafficking activity has transitioned from straight up out on the streets to being brokered through social media.
It's and just now another avenue for them to take advantage of them.
It makes it a lot more easy and efficient. If you can just broker the deal by sitting at your computer and you don't have to actually go pick up a person and bring them to another person, and you can just make the arrangements online, I mean, you're going to make more cash faster. That greases the slides for the economy of trafficking. I would say another thing I would want general community members to be aware of is how much buying activity takes place here, brokered through online activity.
Through websites like Craigslist or?
Well, that's a great question, because I'd mentioned SESTA and FOSTA, two large pieces of legislation that passed, that one of them very specifically targets Craigslist and other online sites like that, which mostly is really good, but what a consequence of that has been that the online communication has gone dark. It's gone even deeper, and so law enforcement and others who would study that, who could effectively in many cases identify people, are struggling with that now, because now that online communication system is out of their purview until they figure that out.
Now it's on the dark web or things like Backpage or...
Backpage went down for the most part. You know, and this was predicted, that if we could challenge Craigslist and Backpage and other more surfaced online marketplaces, so to speak, that it would just cause it to go deeper or darker, like you said. And then law enforcement and others lose some of the traction they had for developing skills for identifying people through online stings or just studying online communications.
So where can people go if they want to find information on how to identify it or help people become more aware?
Yeah, I would direct people to PAVSA, Program for Aid to Victims of Sexual Assault. I would direct people here at the American Indian Community Housing Organization relative to missing and murdered Indigenous women. Mel Alvar, in spite of the surprise motherhood that happened this morning, is our Northeast Minnesota Regional Safe Harbor Navigator, and she'll be back working in April. So I'm not sure who will be handling things in her time away, but I know Caitlin Bicey from North Homes also does safe harbor work. So we have people here in town who have lots of experience utilizing the safe harbor funding in their work.
Anything I'm missing that you want to add?
I guess I would just encourage people to challenge friends, family, neighbors who consume pornography, who bring dancers in for parties, bachelor parties, who may do that when they're up at the hunting shack, to just call that out as not appropriate behavior, illegal behavior. To not normalize it, that's a big problem here, that's still normalized behavior, especially in rural areas, to be paying to have people to entertain you in varying levels of sexual pleasure, whether it's just viewing someone dance or having sex.
You just heard from Kathy Herms, Youth Program Coordinator with Lutheran Social Services in Duluth. Up next, we hear from Fond du Lac Police Chief Herb Finday. He spoke with me recently about a new effort underway called Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking, or TRUST. He also shared his thoughts on the reasons behind why Native American women are disproportionately affected by sex trafficking.
You know, we can talk about historical trauma throughout Indian country. We can talk about how the government has treated us in the past as an Indian nation. I think a lot of that stuff comes into play with that and makes our women and children and our Native American men more susceptible to not only this, but a lot of other things as well. You know, when we could talk about drug use and mental health, I mean, that all comes into play as part of that, you know. And I've talked about it in the past, and I still wholeheartedly believe that, you know, that's part of it. It is Western society colonization has not been in favor of the Native American community, and that's part of that reason for that. Sometimes our old ones, our oral shareholders, you know, they say that in order for us to get back to healing our nation is we need to go back to our old ways and our core culture and our traditions. And I think I'm one of those believers that believe that. And You know, even myself being in law enforcement, I don't police in a traditional manner. I don't police so much in our Western way. You know, I go back and I think about what my ancestors have done in the past before I make a decision. And I think that's helped and also gained some trust within my community, but also implementing that and that aspect into our trust task force of taking care of our people and exercising true sovereignty in that manner.
I guess, what are some of the accomplishments that you've made so far since the Trust Task Force was formed?
So over this past year, all we were doing is laying the groundwork of what our initiative is going to be. You know, we need to get in place our policies and procedures on how the Trust Task Force was going to operate. We also needed to write mutual aids and joint powers agreements that work for every tribe. You know, what works for Fond du Lac is probably not going to work for White Earth Tribe because they're so much bigger than we are. You know, out of Fond du Lac, we have membership of right around 6,700 people, whereas White Earth, you know, they're in 16,000-17,000 or more memberships. And their land base is a lot larger than ours. So those needs and we'll say necessities are a little bit different than Fond du Lac would be. So we need to tailor those mutual aids and those joint powers agreements to those other agencies. So like Kelly was talking about earlier today, you know, it's not something where I could just put a blanket mutual aid together and hand it to Leech Lake and ask them to sign it. And as long as they hold the baseline of what we're trying to do with trust, we're going to sign it. We're going to enter in those mutual aids. We have a mutual aid that's with Mille Lacs right now that hasn't been signed by them, so that they're still looking at it. They're tailoring it to their needs. And, you know, hopefully by 2019, we'll have Mille Lacs Police Department will be part of Trust Task Force also. And I don't know if I talked about what TRUST actually means. It's an acronym for Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking. That's the acronym for TRUST.
Basically, the mutual aid agreements make it easier to share information and to combat human trafficking or sex trafficking?
Yeah, I could talk a little bit more about our mutual aids and JPAs. It basically means that an officer can go on to that agency or that tribe, and they can exercise the same powers as a law enforcement officer on that agency. So let's say Kelly needs to go over to Leech Lake, do an investigation there. She has the same arrest powers on Leech Lake as she does on Fond du Lac. And it's vice versa. So if Cook County Sheriff's Office comes down to Fond du Lac and they want to do an investigation with Kelly here, they have the same arrest powers there too. And that's where that mutual aid comes in. You know, and we also lay some different groundwork in that mutual aid of information sharing and gathering information and how they're going to hold on to it and who's going to be the controlling agency, things of that nature.
So what are the challenges in trying to address this really serious issue?
Recognition is our main challenge right now. And one of the things that we highlighted today was hotels and motels and also gas stations and truck stops. And, you know, is a passerby going to see somebody who's being trafficked, or that they think that somebody's being trafficked, are they actually going to report that? Because they might not have that training. And I think more training needs to be put out there to the public sector, and that's going to be the biggest challenge for this initiative, in my opinion.
Is getting people to realize this is a problem.
Right. You know, I think people realize that it is a problem, but how to recognize that problem? What are the signs of sex trafficking? What are the signs of human trafficking? You know, and once you recognize those signs, I think you're going to be better versed in how you're going to report that crime. And then you can become a witness in that fact, too, of I made this report, so I'm going to play a part in it. And, you know, once that's reported, you know, the investigators are going to hold the individuals accountable. And that needs to start with the public.
So how does the public do that without putting the person who's being trafficked or themselves in danger? You know, for people who aren't in law enforcement and don't do this every day, what's your advice for them?
My advice for them is to don't interact with the individuals, but if you identify something and if you're just talking with them in normal conversation, or whether you are a gas station attendant, treat them like any other customer. But just in turn, after that is that interaction is finished, make that call to 911 and make that report to 911 and go from there. Gather as much information as you can. If you see a vehicle leave the area, talk about what that vehicle looks like. If you can gather a license plate, write down that license plate and report that. If there's any identifying marks on that car, any identifying marks on the male or female that is involved, or anybody that you interacted with, get as much information as you can. But don't turn it into your own rescue operation. Just report it to law enforcement, and we'll go from there.
What are the things that you look for to try and pinpoint anything that might be going wrong?
If a male or female, if they don't have control of their own finances, let's say they're not holding on to their own cash for the day, they don't know what time it is. Simple as not knowing that it's 12 o'clock in the afternoon, when in fact it's probably 3 in the afternoon. You know, things like that. Does this individual speak for themselves? Are they allowed to speak for themselves? Are they allowed to order their own food? Are they allowed to interact with other individuals? Is only one person speaking for them? You know, that is one way to identify somebody who's being trafficked.
And along the highway, you know, at truck stops and gas stations is some of the more common places where you can see that occur, because it's close to the highway and a lot of people are moved back and forth?
I wouldn't say that we can just identify one area along the highway. You know, there's, Kelly, we talk about a circuit, and the circuit is where an individual is holding sex trafficking, and they're going from location to location, where they go from St. Cloud to Minneapolis, then Minneapolis back up to Hinckley, and then Hinckley back up to Cloquet, you know, and that's their circuit that they'll travel. And they won't stay in one place for too long. You know, they might be there for just a couple of days to maybe a couple of weeks. They'll see as much clientele as they can, and then they pick up from there, and they move on to the next town. They'll stay there for as long as they can, whether it's at a hotel, motel, or even some of them are truck stops and some are not truck stops. And some even hold them out of apartment buildings, apartment complexes, or even homes. And people advertise through the internet, they advertise through social media, and that's how they make their contacts. And then they pick up after that after a couple of weeks, and they'll move on to their next town.
I was just talking with Kathy Herms, and she was talking about how they use the internet or resources online for sex trafficking. What are the difficulties for you in law enforcement to track that behavior online?
There's a lot of difficulty in that. You know, it's hard to identify. You could jump on the internet and go to any website where females or males advertise themselves on there, and you're not going to be able to identify just by reading one ad if they're being trafficked by an individual or not. It's up to a seasoned officer or a seasoned task force to be able to identify these individuals while they're advertising on these websites. And sometimes it's you can punch in information, whether they're using their cell phone number. You punch in their cell phone number through a Google search or a complex Google search, and it could come up with many different ads that they might not only advertise in your area, but let's say they advertised in Minneapolis now, or they advertised in Fargo, North Dakota. You can identify that area, and you know, you can you analyze that information that comes in. And it all depends on how you're going to investigate or how you're going to proceed. But that's one way we do it, is gathering that information. It's hard to identify one individual or even one male or one female who's trafficking individuals. She might have, that person might have three or four people that they're trafficking rather than just one. So it's a large-scale investigation sometimes, or sometimes it could be as small as two individuals. To say that it's that we can just punch in on any information we can into a search engine or a advertising site is, I'll say, it's a misnomer. I mean, there's more information that we need to gather by just looking at one website.
So what do you think is going to help or improve the work or the foundation that you've already built on?
Experience and more involvement from the community is what's going to build on this. Like anything, you know, this first year, like I said, our first year has been nothing but setting the groundwork of what we're going to do here in the future. I've asked Kelly to have more operations next year. When I talk about operations, I'm talking about rescue operations, to where you're trying to get an individual who's actually that's trafficking women or trafficking kids or males, and rescue these individuals that are part of that. Or else you have John Stings or Jane Stings, to where you're just starting cases against individuals who are coming into solicitation for sex. And in turn, all that will give you information. These people here that are involved in this trade, they know who's who. So, and you need to make those contacts during those investigations. And to put all your eggs in one basket and just say, we're going to only do John's things, you're not going to be very successful. So you need to open it up to a broader spectrum. And that's what I want the Trust Task Force to do, and that's what I've asked Kelly to do in the future. And I think within 2019, 2020, that's going to be the goal moving forward. And, of course, there's always going to be that educational piece that I want them to take on, too, of educated in the community, educated in hotels and motels, and even hotels on other reservations is going to be our initiative.
Again, you were just listening to Fond du Lac Police Chief Herb Findet. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Julie Brown, who's working to combat sex trafficking with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about sex trafficking and efforts to end sexual exploitation of men, women, and children in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Up next, we hear from Julie Brown. She's a policy advisor with the Wisconsin Department of Justice and operations director for the Wisconsin Crime Victims' Rights Board. In the last year, the Wisconsin DOJ launched a human trafficking bureau to investigate sex trafficking cases. In 2018, the agency reached around 5,000 people through trainings it's conducting to help industry spot signs of sex trafficking.
We have been reaching out to industries that either run businesses that are likely to be exploited by traffickers, or maybe they're a business that just by the nature of the business, they might be more likely to encounter victims or traffickers. We want to turn the tables on traffickers by educating the workforce within those industries so that people know what they're seeing when they see it. So we have done a series of targeted outreach over the last year. We've done outreach with the hotel and hospitality industry. We work with Motor Carriers Association. We work with Truckers Against Trafficking. We have done training in tribal casinos and with tribal employees. And then healthcare organizations. Our biggest outreach, most recent outreach really was with the transportation industry. That's ongoing, in fact. But the transportation outreach then has a lot of different tenets to it. The purpose of it, of course, is that traffickers move victims around a lot, and they do that sometimes to evade detection. They want to make money in different communities, so they move victims of sex trafficking around to different venues. Obviously, they use our roadways. They're at gas stations. They're at rest stops. They get stopped, I'm sure, by State Patrol. State Patrol makes, I think it's 244,000 traffic stops a year. So they were one of the partnerships that we were most eager to get started with. And we have a great relationship with the State Patrol. Our Human Trafficking Bureau works very closely with their Special Operations Division. And we work together on training in order to make sure that members of the State Patrol are also getting information about indicators of trafficking on the roadways. I mentioned we worked with Truckers Against Trafficking. That's a national organization. They have trained hundreds of thousands of people in the industry. And really, their experience is our proof that industry outreach works. They have taken a group, truckers, who are one of, you know, it's a group that is targeted by traffickers often as a potential customer base. And really, due to the work of Truckers Against Trafficking, who have reached 600,000 people in the industry now, is their last number. They have turned this group into a group that actually contributes a significant number of leads to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So there's proof in what they've done that when drivers know what to look for, they know how to make a call, that can make a difference. So we're working with traffickers, but we're also taking the model and the concept of that and applying it to multiple industries. There are certain indicators that you can see, you know, that are industry specific. And so by training people on the front lines to look for certain things or recognize things when they see them as part of their everyday job, We want to increase the number of tips that come in. We want to increase the quality of tips that come in. We also want to make sure that people in those sectors understand for the safety of themselves and also of their clients what trafficking is and how their business might be exploited by traffickers.
And you said you've been doing a lot of trainings over the past year. So do you have any trainings that are coming up where you're doing this work with, whether it's like truckers or the hospitality industry? Or
we do. We're going to have a series of training that we're doing within the busing industry, which again is a segment of our transportation industry outreach. We're going to hit all the regional safety meetings for the Wisconsin School Bus Association in the spring, and we will continue to do the work that we've been doing with the State Patrol. And we've got a strong partnership with Motor Carriers Association, and we can, through that association, get information and keep getting information to transportation industry people that are members. So that's trucking, motor coach, school buses.
Okay.
School buses, is the busing industry is a fairly new area of outreach, and that is actually something that we're using the model put forth by Truckers Against Trafficking. They now have a busing industry outreach called Busing on the Lookout. So they've developed materials that are very good, including training videos and written materials. So we've been putting those out with our things everywhere that we're at. And when we go and do this round of training with the School Bus Association, we're going to use their materials as well with our own materials so that people are getting the same message in Wisconsin that they're getting in other states with these materials as well.
Are you teaching school bus drivers what to look for among kids that are heading off to school every day? Or
yeah, the busing materials are, they can apply to commercial or to school buses. It's a slightly different message for both. But as far as school buses, yes. So there's the issue of, you know, our school bus drivers see our kids every day. They know the neighborhoods. They know the bus stops. They might be the last person to see somebody who's going to school that decides not to go to school anymore, or who's taken, you know, somewhere by a trafficker or going somewhere as part of the cycle of victimization. There are certain things that one can look for in school-age children. Some of the things are, you know, showing up with expensive gifts and things that they didn't have before, talking about an older boyfriend or girlfriend, talking about visiting other cities over the weekend. It could be that this child is showing behavioral changes, appearance changes, saying these kinds of things. Maybe there's somebody waiting for them at their bus stop. So you can see there are a lot of things that we could talk about that a bus driver might pick up on. I mean, they might see some of the clues that nobody else is seeing. And so, like with all of the industry outreach, we want to give them the information so that if they see these things, maybe they can put them in context and, you know, make a call. Just make a call. We always tell people you don't have to be right. It's a suspicion, right? You have some information. People are afraid, like, what if I'm wrong? Maybe I shouldn't call because I don't know for sure. That's law enforcement's job, or that's going to be, you know, social services' job to figure out. But the things that we see that might be an indicator that a child is in trouble really do make a difference. They fill in a piece of the puzzle that maybe we don't have in the system. So make the call. I always say, don't worry about, you know, don't say to yourself, what if I'm wrong? Say, what if I'm right? You know, what if I have this piece of information that nobody else has? And depending on the industry that we're working with, it might have more to do with things that lead up to somebody being trafficked. Youth are often lured away. They're groomed, they're romanced into the life. And once they figure out what the game is, they don't like it, they want to leave, often that's when the violence starts. So it certainly is the case sometimes that people are brought in by violence and by force. It's much more likely that somebody is going to be lured in and they're going to be shown affection and they're going to become bonded to this person. They probably wouldn't even consider themselves victims of trafficking. they would describe their trafficker probably as a boyfriend. They might say their relationship is dysfunctional or maybe a little bit abusive, but they might not identify this as human trafficking because of the dynamics. We see it for what it is from the outside, but they might not see it that way. So it's not like people are often going to have somebody run up to them and say, I'm a victim of trafficking, help me. It could happen, right? But that's not usually how it's going to present.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, depending on a person's background, too, and what they grew up in, they might not characterize certain behaviors as abnormal because they've always been treated that mm-hmm. way.
That's exactly right. People who have a history of abuse or, you know, dysfunctional relationships or lack of affection at home, they're going to seek out something better, but they don't have a frame of reference always for what a healthy relationship is. And you're absolutely right about that. If they've been abused before, they might think that that's part of a relationship, you know, that that always happens.
Well, and it's too bad, too, that it has to, I mean, like, it's good that all these trainings are taking a place across all these different industries, mm-hmm. but I think a lot of people would be sad to think of kids getting on the school bus, you know, being groomed for sex trafficking.
Yes, you know, it's a dark issue, that's for sure. You know, we go to all kinds of different groups. I mean, it's been a priority of our department to get out into the community. We get a lot of requests. Every week, more requests come in for us to go to community groups. And we also go, of course, to systems-based venues. You know, we've trained at the Department of Corrections, and, of course, we train law enforcement, and we go to conferences and things like that. But we also go to, you know, conferences that aren't criminal justice-based conferences or county-based meetings of people that work in social services. Or again, you know, hotels, casinos. We have been in community groups, as community awareness groups call us in. We've been at educational facilities. You know, it's one of those things that I think it can be difficult to talk about because it's something that is dark and it is sad. You know, you're talking about extremely vulnerable people who are then further exploited in the worst possible way. But the flip side to that is I really feel like there has been a shift in awareness about this. I've been involved in public policy related to human trafficking for about a decade, and I believe that we are in the best situation we've ever been in terms of people seeing victims as victims, especially youth. So, you know, it wasn't that long ago that they would be referred to as child prostitutes, right? But now I think more and more people are understanding there is no such thing as a child prostitute. It's a person who's being prostituted. It's a youth who's a victim of human trafficking. And they're not out there because they want to be. They're out there because they are forced or tricked to be out there. Or they're doing it because the one person in their life that they think is giving them affection, even though they're really exploiting them, has asked them to do this. So it's sad, but we're also at a point in time where people are more aware of what the dynamics are, and that's what we need. You know, we need every person to understand the dynamics, that it's not the Lifetime movie version. They're not always tied up and in handcuffs. They are people who are out among us. They are kids, our sisters, our brothers. They're being exploited. They don't have any place to sleep tonight, right? They don't have a way to get food. Some of these kids don't have a single person in their life looking out for them. But I feel like that's changing because I see how much people care about this and how much they want to be part of the solution. And when we go to a hotel or, you know, we're talking to truckers, they want to be that person that sees it and makes a call. You know, and it is not uncommon after a presentation, someone will come up to us and say, you know, I saw this and I didn't recognize it for what it was. And now I know, you know, and next time I see something like this, I am going to call.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be thankful for in terms of where we're at right now. There's more collaboration than there ever has been. There's more community awareness than there's been. We're going to keep it up. We'll keep doing it. And I have to believe that that's going to make a difference over time. The more educated we are about the subtle signs and what to do, and the more comfortable people are with making the call, the more progress we're going to make.
Wow. When you reach thousands of people, you know, and thinking about them also being able to pass on what they've learned, I'm sure it's like hotel managers or people who train their employees to look for the same things, right?
That's right. So, you know, some of the outreach, for example, we did training at a mall, and we trained the security team at the mall, about 34 business owners at the mall. So, you know, it was a relatively smallish group. It was around 40 people, but all of these people had other people that they were in charge of, and they were, right, they were going to go use these indicators. They were going to spread the word. We also gave them a list of resources for their area. Because, you know, you might see a kid in the context of a shoplifting situation who you see these flags and, you know, you can't do anything with them at that point. But understanding that they have certain needs, we wanted people to have a list of resources so they could refer them back to people who could help them if it wasn't a case where law enforcement was going to be called in. I think those kinds of things are going to have an impact that we can't measure. We might never even know about, you know, on our end. But very much worth our time. We're invested in getting out there into the community and talking to people like that. In the mall situation, too, we talked a lot about recruitment. You know, what does that look like in the food court? And it's a balance for industry. Same with hotels that are based on being welcoming, right? They want to be a happy place. They are a place people go to for entertainment. They want to respect the privacy of their clients. So when we work together, we have to find that balance that works for the business and helps advance our goals as well. So it's always about what can we do within the context of your business, you know, and your building that is going to be fruitful. So it looks different everywhere we go because we really want to respect the fact that people have a business to run. The flip side, of course, is that they also want to protect all their clients. They want a safe environment for their staff and for the people who come. So they're balancing interests themselves as they do this. But, you know, some places it might be good to put up a poster with the national hotline. Other places don't want it to be so front and center because of the nature of their business. But they will sit down with us with their security team, and we do a lot of behind-the-scenes things with them. For example, with the hotels, we worked on a reporting protocol. So a lot of hotels have these binders so that they can, you know, whoever's on staff, when there's an emergency, they flip through their binders. If there's a power outage, they go to that page and it has the steps, you know, who you call and what you do next. We created a protocol that they can put into those binders related to human trafficking so that whoever's on staff, you know, then they had to come up with what their protocol would be, who's the person that's going to be in charge of this, who's their local law enforcement person to connect with, you know, halt certain things within the hotel to preserve evidence. Do they have any information that they can gather? So, you know, whether somebody wants to have the issue be really visible for them as part of their corporate philanthropy or whether they just want to be part of the solution but really don't want to make much of it, we have people in both of those categories, and we're very happy to work with them.
Again, you were just listening to Julie Brown, policy advisor with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll bring you an update on how Jamie Kloss was found and what happens now. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. 13-year-old Jamie Kloss has been found alive. Authorities identified her kidnapper as 21-year-old Jake Thomas Patterson of Gordon. He's being held on two counts of first-degree intentional homicide for the murder of Jamie's parents and one count of kidnapping. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Jeannie Nutter. She's the woman who found Kloss yesterday afternoon.
I just took Henry out for a walk, and we walked the circle because it's a good walk. It's about 1.6 miles or so. And as I got to my driveway, which would be the end of the walk, this young girl was coming towards me, and she was saying, "Please help me. I don't know where I am. I'm lost." And Just a little background on me. I was a child protection social worker. I was in CPS for 30-some years. So my background is in social work and child protection. So my CPS skills, which I haven't used in a while because I've been retired, went into gear. She came up to me. I went to her. She told me who she was. And I immediately said to myself, don't let her know you're a little terrified. Get her to a safe place. So I didn't want to bring her to my cabin, even though we were at the driveway of it, because it's close proximity to where she has been. And I didn't know, I knew nothing of the circumstances of where what was going on in the place. So I wanted she and I to be someplace with other people. So we went to one house where I thought somebody would be home, and they weren't. And then down the road from me is a teacher and her husband and two kids, and I figured she would be home because it was after school hours. So I just brought Jamie there, and I banged on their door, and I said, don't ask me any questions. Just call 911 right now because I have Jamie. And they recognized her because Chris is a teacher. So, you know, schools have in Wisconsin have been very active in doing fundraising and things, and her picture's all over. So we called 911, and the police came, and she's safe. And that's what happened.
Well, when you saw her, was she running towards you or...
No, she wasn't running. She was walking, but she, you know, I could tell she didn't. I could tell she left where she had been. She left in a hurry because she had shoes on that didn't fit her, and just a sweatshirt and some leggings. So, you know, I just grabbed onto her and held her because it's very icy up here. And I
so
told
she
her,
didn't have any shoes on. Is that what you're saying? Like she just had sweatshirt and leggings on, or?
Yes, because I felt like she must have left in a hurry, but I didn't. My job was not to ask her questions. My job was to get her to a safe place, which we did.
Okay. And when you got her to your neighbor's house, you know, what happened then?
I said, please call 911. And they didn't ask me any questions. They brought us in the house. We wrapped Jamie in a blanket because I knew she was cold. Dispatch kept us on the phone until the deputies arrived.
And what was she like? I mean, did she seem okay? Or
well, I would say she's a child who's been traumatized, and so I can't. You know, who knows? I mean, she's got a long road ahead of her in recovery and therapy, but she seemed calm, and I think, you know, I tried to keep her calm and not, I mean, I tried to be calm so that, and everybody, you know, everyone did a great job. The dispatch was wonderful. The cops were great. My dog, he was a little wild, but was different for him. I think she was probably in shock maybe, but all I wanted to do was get her someplace safe.
And did she say anything, or was she, I mean, what was kind of her state of mind?
I just kept telling her everything is going to be okay. You're going to be safe. We're going to get to, you know, the teacher's house, Chris's house. I just was saying reassuring things to her that she was going to be okay. I didn't grill her or ask her questions because I didn't want her to be more traumatized by me asking things that I shouldn't. So.
Because you're, as you said, in your experience with Child Protection Services, this is something that you kind of knew how to handle?
Oh, yeah, because I knew the police are going to ask her questions, and she's got so much of that ahead of her. I did not want to add to that. I did not want to be part of her trauma. I just wanted her to be safe, and that was my only goal, and we did it.
And so about how long was she there before the police arrived?
For me, it felt like days before they got there, but in reality, it was probably, you know, because we're 40 miles from Superior, and it was Douglas County Sheriff that were responding. So I don't know who was in the area, but a wonderful sheriff's deputy came, and another pair, a male and female, and they took her immediately, which was great. They got her out. So probably 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes, 20 minutes. I don't know. I have no idea how long it took, really.
Okay. Well, what was that like for you when you saw her? I mean, did you immediately recognize her, or?
Not until I got closer to her, and then when she told me who she was, I did recognize her, and all I wanted to do was get that kid out of the cold and safe. No matter who she had been, you know, she just needed to be someplace safe, so.
And it has been very cold these last few days.
Yeah, and it's just crappy up here. I mean, the sun is out today, but, I mean, our road is just glare ice. You can't really walk on it unless you have, you know, some kind of thing on your shoes, yak tracks or something. So I just wanted her to be in a safe place. And we were walking on the road, and I did ask her what color car this person was in case I saw the car. Then I had to have plan B of what we were going to do. But I got her to Chris and Peter's house, and we got the police, and that's what happened.
Again, you were just listening to Jeannie Nutter, who found 13-year-old Jamie Kloss about 11 miles from Gordon yesterday afternoon. Kloss escaped from her kidnapper, 21-year-old Jake Thomas Patterson, who is being held on two counts of first-degree intentional homicide for the murder of Jamie's parents and one count of kidnapping. Authorities say they believe Kloss was Patterson's only target. Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald says Patterson, quote, planned his actions and took many steps to hide his identity, unquote. Patterson had no prior criminal record. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.